Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There are two sides to the story of the Bulger brothers. The first is about the road not taken. This is the story of how the elder brother, James, or Whitey Bulger, was drawn like a mob character in a crime novel into a life of FBI snitching and murder, and how his younger brother, William, or Billy Bulger, rose to the top of Massachusetts state politics and went on to head the state university. The other story comes after. After James Whitey Bulger became one of the nation's most wanted criminals, after he disappeared, that was some 8 years ago, to nobody knows where, because this is the after that matters today. You see, for years, the younger brother William stayed clear of the dirt storm around his brother. You know, he can't punish all the boys if one goes bad. But the blood that keeps brothers together is now starting to congeal around the career of the UMass president. Questions about the connections between the brothers prompted the state's top law enforcer to say this week that you can't head an institution that teaches truth and then plead the fifth every time your brother's name comes up. And so, Connection listeners, simple question. Does loyalty matter? Loyalty to a brother, no matter how rotten, or loyalty to a justice system, to the rules of society? Loyalty. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In this hour, we'll talk with David Kaczynski. He's the man who, 7 years ago, chose to turn in his brother Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. We'll also have with us today one of America's brightest legal minds, Professor Patricia Williams. And we're going to start with the Boston Herald columnist whose story helped catapult questions about the Bulger brothers onto the national stage. Peter Gelsenis is here with me in the studio. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning, Dick.
Quite a dramatic turn on this tale of two brothers this week when Attorney General O'Reilly says, yes, you know, in fact, I'm going to break with Democratic Party tradition and say that the younger brother, the university president, should no longer hold the job. Were you surprised when he said that?
Let me first say it's Tom Riley.
What did I say?
Not O'Reilly.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, I just wanted to clarify
that.
Was I surprised? I guess you're always surprised when a public figure speaks as clearly and plainly and unequivocally as he did. He is not only the top law enforcement officer in the state, he's also the top Democratic elected office holder in the state. Billy Bulger is and was a legendary Democratic power broker in the state as Senate president and now UMass president. So, for somebody to lay it out as clearly and plainly as Tom did, I think that's always stunning. It's always stunning in its simplicity.
What changed?
Well, I think the revelation of Bulger's grand jury testimony about a year ago. This is where he did say that he felt no obligation to help anybody assist in his brother's
capture
and bringing him to justice. And not only that, there was the revelation of a phone call that was made. Whitey made it to him at a neutral site. Billy had to leave his house to go to a neutral location to accept this phone call. This was when Whitey's been a fugitive for eight and a half years. This was about a year into his fugitive run. And what Billy said to the grand jury about that call was that he dissuaded, if you will, Whitey from coming in, from coming back in to face to take his chances with the justice system because, quote, he didn't feel it was in his interest to do so.
Well, Peter, you're from the same neighborhood in South Boston, right?
South Boston, correct, all my life.
And so you know both these brothers, or you see them on the street.
Well, I don't. I wouldn't say we're
like
personal friends or anything, but oh yes, I mean they commanded the landscape for a good part of certainly my life growing up there.
And going back to that point when Whitey Bulger was living a life of crime and his brother was making his way in politics. Before the law started to crack down, were they close at that point? Was there, or had they said, you know, I have to stay as far away from you as possible in order to do what it is that I want to do?
The myth, is that they led parallel lives. Even though they lived within the same very small neighborhood, operated in the same space. But the myth was they led parallel lives. Now we know in the over the past years that there have been a great many very interesting, intriguing, dramatic points of intersection. We knew it then. There were situations, for instance, where political people were punished for what they did or didn't do to Whitey. For instance, Whitey was suddenly placed on a payroll of the Suffolk County Courthouse as a janitor. He just appeared there. The clerk, John E. Powers, who ironically, also a South Boston man, also Senate president when Billy was just starting in politics in 1960, when Powers realized that Whitey suddenly appeared on the payroll, Powers took him off the payroll, and Powers paid a price for that. His salary was frozen for years. So there were all these dramatic points of intersection. There was a state trooper who stopped Whitey as Whitey was about to board a plane in Montreal with what was described as two bricks of money. And one of his assistants, Whitey snatched the money off the security belt, tossed it to one of his assistants. Assistant ran away. The money was never captured. Whitey was questioned by the state trooper, but the state trooper, feeling that he didn't really have a pinch there or an arrest there, chose not to bring him in. State trooper wrote a report, a 4.5-page narrative that very, very few people other than his boss knew about. And about 2 to 3 days after he writes this report, the head of Massport, the executive director of Massport, which controls Logan Airport, and this position is a very political position, suddenly shows up for the first time unannounced at the Troop F barracks at Logan Airport looking for a copy of this report. And the trooper says, you give me a receipt, I'll give you the report. The gentleman turns around and does not want to leave a receipt.
All these allegations, though, that William Billy Bulger may have helped his brother over the years, before he disappeared and afterwards, never, ever hurt his career. Why is that?
People seem to acknowledge the dividing line, that you know, the common refrain is he's not responsible, he's not his brother's keeper, he's not responsible for what his brother does. And people seem to abide by that. Plus, you were talking about a man at their height. You were talking about the fellow who, one brother who controlled everything criminal in the area, in Boston, and particularly in South Boston, and the man who controlled everything political.
Let's hear from our law professor here. Patricia Williams is not just a professor of law, she's a writer. She too is a columnist, and she's also a student of social behavior, how we live in that murky area between what the law says and all those other rules we live by. Hi, Patricia.
Hello, good morning.
You've been thinking about this case, I'm told.
I have been. It's an interesting one that does convey in many people a kind of tension between moral, religious notions of, am I my brother's keeper? What about being a good Samaritan in the world? And the practical limits of legal obligations about when the law doesn't necessarily impose a duty to report or to witness or to come forward in each and every instance if you see somebody injured or if you see somebody in trouble. And there are a variety of rationales for that, some better than others. Again, I think it's a balance between, I think, the common perception that we value honesty, truth, a kind of autonomy of individuals and bravery to tell of crimes that we see. And again, the context exemplified here of intimate relations, privacy, the practicalities of the state coming in and forcing, and what is the limit of that force, intimates to testify against one another.
What does the law say, though? Can we begin with that? Because the law says I wouldn't necessarily have to testify against my wife if she were to have been accused of a crime. Is there anything like that, brother to brother?
The privileges are There is the reason that William Bulger was called before a grand jury is that he does not necessarily have a privilege. What he asserted was actually the Fifth Amendment privilege, which is the
protection of himself, though.
Protection,
right?
Of himself, yes. Privileges like lawyer client or reporter source, priest penitent, psychotherapist patient have one set of justifications having to do usually with a relationship that is a fiduciary relationship where somebody in a position of relative power acts as a kind of channel or a verbalizer to make a case for another. And I think that those are somewhat distinguishable from the family privilege, spousal privilege, parent-children privileges, which have to do with a notion of integrity, but perhaps a different one than what one commonly thinks of as, again, this commitment to honesty at all costs. But integrity having to do with the literal root of the word, almost an Aristotelian notion of the self as an integer, to be at one with the self and not to require the self to split off from the self. And in that sense, where one is intimately involved with another in an emotional level, how does the state come in and force them to testify in a way that they cannot live with themselves? And it is a recognition that again is not very popular, particularly in an unsympathetic context such as this. But it, again, it does have to do with a competing moral value and how we balance that.
Do you think
the public interest against the constraints of certain notions of private integrity.
Do you think, Patricia, that the increased pressure on William Bulger to speak about his brother has to do with a change that we're watching in society as a whole in those relationships being chipped away at?
Yes, I do. I do think that this is very much related to a kind of ideology of extreme individualism, that each of us is a kind of rational economic actor with almost a set of hard surfaces that don't necessarily intersect with others, mm-hmm. A notion, an ideology of ultimate responsibility for the self and not for others. Again, this has much to recommend it, particularly as an economic notion. Again, I think sometimes it understates the power of family relations. Again, I don't want to make the case that this penumbra, this uncertain area of intimacy should govern in any and all cases. And I think it becomes more and more difficult the farther out you move from the most intimate family relations.
Right.
I think that's why the spousal relationship is perhaps at the center of this. It becomes less convincing as one moves from, you know, to more extended family. One hears the same kinds of arguments made by not just blood but contiguity, for example, families, larger families as defined, for example, in the context of organized crime, neighborhoods protecting themselves because there's a tension between in certain places where they feel under siege both from official corruption and street violence, so their sense of allegiance or their sense of community.
I have to stop you there, Patricia. We'll pick it up when we come back after the break. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255 to join our conversation about loyalty, brothers, and the justice system. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And the story of the Bulger brothers is what we're focusing on this hour, and whether or not the increased pressure on the younger Bulger to speak more frankly about his fugitive older brother is an indication of a change in Boston or Massachusetts politics or something a little bit larger that's going on. Our number, again, 1-800-423-TALK for you to join us. And I have with me on the program Patricia Williams. She's a professor of law at Columbia University. She's currently on leave writing a book. She's a contributing editor and a columnist for The Nation magazine. Here with me in the studio, Peter Gelsenis. He's a columnist for the Boston Herald and one of the lead reporters covering the saga of the Bulger brothers. And Peter, you had a question for Patricia.
Yes, Patricia, hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to ask you your opinion or get your thoughts on simply the morality of the issue at hand. Tom Riley based his comments to me on the idea of a man forced to make a decision, and he understood the decision, and it was his decision to make as to which path, as he called it, Bill wanted to take in this situation, and he framed it in terms of a moral argument, and his suggestion, his call for Bulger to resign is based purely on that, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on that as a point.
Well, I think that there was one of the things that Riley said, if I'm not mistaken, is that I, as Attorney General, would never be able to make the argument that he's making, that Bulger, that William Bulger is making, which is absolutely true. As an Attorney General, he is under a legal obligation. And I think it's somewhat different than his presidency as the head of a university. So I would distinguish between the legal obligation he faces in his position and the public sentiment, with which I am quite sympathetic, quite frankly, that perhaps given the public nature of it and the heinousness of his brother's crimes and the ambiguity of his own moral statements in his brother's defense, that he may not be the appropriate person for the job. So in terms of the job, if that's what you're asking me, I have less of a problem with the way in which the public debate is unraveling. But I do think it's a judgment call rather than a legal obligation. And I think that there is a moral balance to be made. And again, this is a case in which there's tremendous a tremendous set of crimes at stake.
Right. He also said that people in positions of public trust. I understand exactly what you're saying about his position specifically. But he also said that people in positions of public trust really have a moral obligation to a moral component to the jobs they hold. And I just wonder if that is something you also have a comment on.
I think it's a fairly broad obligation, as phrased in that fashion, and I would probably back away from saying that any and all positions of public trust for any and all purposes require somebody always to testify against a family member. I think that, again, to distinguish it from the Attorney General's office, it depends upon where the trust relates directly to the subject.
What about Riley's contention that a man at the helm of a university, by the nature of the university, by the definition, the mission of a university and its pursuit of truth and knowledge, puts a little bit more moral imperative to the equation?
I actually think that the pursuit of truth to which a university is dedicated is a somewhat different moral proposition. Now, again, this is going to be controversial. I'm sure we'll get calls about it. I think it's a somewhat different proposition than what Bulger faces in his decision whether to testify about his brother. And again, I think because the obligation to testify. And again, it's very hard for me to answer because one isn't quite sure what he would testify to. But assuming he is not an actual accomplice to the murders, this has something to do with the ability to live with himself, the ability to provide perhaps what the law has recognized in certain situations as a kind of counsel, even for criminals. And a place to unburden one's heart is in the penitent priest or the psychotherapist patient relationship, that this does not necessarily, if he is not an active participant or an accomplice, this does not necessarily conflict with the ultimate revelations of truth to which, for example, he might encourage his brother to turn himself in.
Patricia, let's hear from someone who has actually faced this dilemma in the past. David Kaczynski is joining us on the line now. He faced this choice back in 1995, 1996, because David Kaczynski's brother, Ted, who we now know as the Unabomber, was at that time still an unknown person. And it was David Kaczynski's poring over the Unabomber's manifesto published, excuse me, in a newspaper that, well, David, I don't want to tell all your story for you, but led you first to believe that, oh, my God, my brother and the Unabomber may be the same person.
Yes, yeah. It's hard to describe what a difficult position that is. I don't know if you can really imagine unless you've been there. In my case, there was some sense that I was facing a horrible dilemma. We understood, and when I say we, I'm speaking of my wife, Linda, because this was certainly a joint decision for us. We understood that if we did nothing, there was a chance that other people might be murdered. And it was hard to imagine being able to live with ourselves knowing that we'd been in a position to prevent that. On the other hand, we also knew that my brother's crimes qualified as capital crimes, that if he was indeed the Unabomber and convicted, that he could be put to death. And I found that a difficult thing to imagine, too, living with myself, knowing that I had turned my brother in to be executed.
If you thought, David, at the time that your brother would never kill again, do you think you might not have turned him in?
Well, I think, you know, it's the problem with hypotheticals is that you really don't know. Reality is always different, and that wasn't the choice I was facing. Of course, there was a possibility that he wouldn't kill again. In fact, whoever the Unabomber was had promised that if his manifesto was published, he wouldn't kill again. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I didn't think I could trust that promise. Originally, you framed this, you know, this question, this division, as a loyalty to one's brother
right.
or to the justice system, and I would have to say my loyalty was not so much to the justice system per se as it was to humanity, the sense that, gee, if I don't do something, some poor guy or lady is going to, you know, open a package and be killed or severely injured, and that's where my loyalty lay. If anything, the justice system, particularly with the death penalty and the whole politics and media notoriety surrounding this case, clouded everything, I think.
And looking back on the decision that you did make, are you happy with your decision to go to the police? Do you have second thoughts, reservations? You and your brother don't speak, I understand.
Well, happy isn't the word I would use. There's nothing happy about this for the Kaczynski family or for any of the people harmed. You know, when my brother was arrested, a live bomb was found in a package under his bed. I think the implication is that if we hadn't come forward, probably someone would have died. You know, I think it's given us the feeling that we probably saved somebody's life, and that's some consolation. And I guess some hope that we've, Linda and I, have been a positive role model for other people who may be faced with similar situations. And I think it's also given me some credibility as an advocate against the death penalty, because, in my case, the justice system worked closely with us to prevent the violence. But once my brother was arrested, their agenda changed, and I certainly wasn't prepared for the game-like quality of what I saw. I mean, it wasn't about justice. It was about politics. It was about institutional agendas. It was about revenge. It seems in this whole situation in Massachusetts, there are similar problems. I understand that one person spent a considerable amount of time in prison, though he was innocent, and the FBI were aware that he was innocent and did nothing to correct that injustice.
That's right. That's right.
So my point of view would be that, you know, you can't use someone else's failures as an excuse not to fulfill your own human responsibility. I think Linda and I did the right thing. I would encourage people to follow our example. But there's a second part of this, and the second part is we must insist as citizens that our criminal justice system be held to a higher standard and that human values be given a central position and focus within that system.
Peter Gelsnes, you've got a quick question.
Good morning, sir. I just wanted to tell you, I don't know if you were aware of this, that in this particular debate here locally and in the state, your name is intoned numerous times as an example and as a precedent for what people are talking about here, particularly in terms of framing it as a moral question. So I just want you to know that when people make the argument, they often use your name.
I guess it's good to know. I just feel a little uncomfortable if that argument, if my name is being harnessed to any sort of political agenda and political hay is being made out of this when I think the moral issues, the human questions at stake here, certainly ought to transcend politics. And, you know, we see that serious problems with the criminal justice system across our country, innocent people on death row, the racial and class bias, and I think the people that are asking Mr. Bulger to do the right thing should also be prepared to do the right thing when it comes to reforming imbalances in our criminal justice system.
Let's take our first caller now from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill's on the line. Hi, Bill.
Boy, did your guest, Mr. Kaczynski, nail this on the nail right on the head. Look, William Bulger took an oath. He swore that he would uphold the laws of this particular commonwealth. If he could not fulfill that oath, he should never have taken it. If he found out later on he could not fulfill that oath, he should have resigned. He didn't. I'm sick to death of public officials who do not have the integrity to keep their oath, and I'm also sick to death of people who do not take public officials to task for not keeping their oath.
Can I ask you a hypothetical question, Bill?
Sure.
If it were to come out that, in fact, he has had very little or next to no or none at all, no contact at all with his brother over the past 8 years, would that change your attitude?
Let me put it to you this way. When he said, quote, he felt no obligation to help the law in apprehending his brother, right then and there, that disqualified him, period. We're talking about a situation where it's not just simply him and his brother. People have lost their lives. People's lives have been ruined because of his brother. And if he can't see that, I grant you he's in caught between the rock and the hard place.
Right.
But it's a situation that is more than just simply him, and it's more than just simply his brother. This is a disgrace. And another factor that was brought out earlier at the beginning of your show, there's some evidence, and it's not even conjecture. There's fact involved here, where anybody who was attempting to cross Whitey suddenly had political problems. Now, come on. This is an abuse of power, okay, in every sense of that word.
Let me take the first part and ask Patricia Williams in on this one, because if in fact the younger brother said that he would do nothing to help those arrest his older brother, at one level, you can respond to it exactly like Bill did. And at another level, you can say he's being very honest and saying, you know what, I'm not going to participate in this. You have law enforcement officials. You deal with it. Is there a way of splitting those two, Patricia?
Well, again, he is not under he's not under a particular obligation to do one thing or another. If he's called as a witness, he can refuse to testify, as we've seen. And given his position, he is then very predictably subject to the political fallout from that. He is a kind of public figure. Again, where I draw the line is whether or not there is an automatic disqualification for his job. I'm not sure that either the ethical or the legal rules would say that he must automatically be disqualified. I think that the public outcry is rooted in what your caller suggests, which is a community sense that he knows more than he is willing to share, and that his refusal to, therefore, that his statement that he's not going to cooperate has much more sinister implications than simply he's...
I would also point out that we're talking about, in terms of Whitey Bulger, we're talking about a fugitive who ranks between Eric Rudolph and Osama bin Laden on the FBI's most wanted list. There is a $1 million bounty on his head at the moment. So in terms of the gravity of how law enforcement in the justice system views him, it's there. And also, to follow up on something Mr. Kaczynski said, and I think it should be mentioned, Mr. Kaczynski talked about his wanting to make sure that there was nobody else hurt or maimed. There is a sense here that Whitey is extremely dangerous, and that the people, while they may not be random people who might fall victim to him necessarily, there is the sense that anybody who makes a move on him is in jeopardy. So it has been mentioned that by Williams' refusal to stated refusal not to help anybody assist in this capture, there is a sense that if a law enforcement official somewhere, anywhere in the world were to move on him and were to be killed in that, then you know, where would the moral responsibility for that lie?
David Kaczynski, a quick last question to you. You had a choice. You could either go to the police with what you knew or not. And what Patricia is saying is that those choices aren't so much there anymore, that there's more and more pressure on people to, you know, sort of work against those relationships. Do you see that change happening as well?
You know, I'm not sure that's so. If I really saw a change, I think people in my position or other people who had done the right thing and turned in family members would be treated more gently by the justice system, and that is certainly not happening. There's a guy named Bill Babbitt who turned in his brother in California, and his brother was executed despite the fact that he was mentally ill and despite the fact that Bill had received promises from the police that his brother would get help for his mental illness. There's a current case in California, a young man turned in by his own parents, and they're charging this thing capitally. I think we have a kind of dissociation here. I mean, the criminal justice system has its set of blinders. And on the other hand, human beings are kind of wrestling with these kind of moral and ethical questions. And I think those two questions are linked. And we need to explore not just the responsibility of somebody in my position, but the responsibility of society to work against violence and for justice.
David, thanks for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
David Kaczynski, former social worker, now directs New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty. His brother, Ted Kaczynski, is known to all of us as the Unabomber, and David turned him in. We'll talk more about that when we come back. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And we're looking at the case of the Bulger brothers and what questions it raises about parents or siblings and whether or not they should have the exemptions from testifying against spouses, for example, whether or not it should be illegal to withhold information about a relative who's a fugitive from justice. 1-800-423-8255. Straight back to the phones now. To Boston, Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
Fine.
I wanted to really decry the kind of moralism expressed by the last caller and echo the ambivalence of Patricia Williams and David Kaczynski. I think there's a critical distinction between Whitey Bulger's case and David Kaczynski's brother. Kaczynski had not been identified, and there was a danger that he would harm others.
Right.
In the case of Whitey Bulger, he's an identified individual who's a fugitive.
But as Peter is pointing out, though, Paul, there's no reason to believe that Whitey Bulger, if he is a murderer, has gone off to a cabin and disappeared somewhere. That he could still may still be a risk to society.
Well, sure, he could be, but I think there's a balancing that has to take place. I think we have enough anecdotal evidence, black mass and other writings, that suggest that even if, let's say, Billy has spoken to him in the past as a brother, also as an attorney, there's got to be concern here at the root because of the involvement, his reputed involvement of the FBI, also winks and nods by the state police in the past, that if Whitey Bulger were apprehended, whether in fact or he were identified in terms of his location, whether in fact he would survive to face prosecution, I think any rational person has to have that concern. Secondly, I think the public lambasting of Billy Bulger is really unfortunate because, yes, Whitey Bulger, from all the depictions of his activities, is a reprehensible person. But when the public suggests that an individual has to surrender his own siblings, that intrudes on the most basic unit of our society, family. I don't think individuals are under an obligation, clearly not under a legal obligation. And I don't think they're under a moral obligation, absent some other extenuating circumstances, to simply come forward and announce to the media or anywhere else publicly, yes, I've done X, Y, and Z interest with my brother.
Okay, Paul, I want to just go to Patricia on this first. Mm-hmm. And that, Patricia, is, again, in that gray area between what the law says ought to be done and what's morally right and how you somehow reconcile that, because, you know, what Paul is saying is that, you know, the law maybe ought not to force the type of, news from William Bolger that people think he may have. And yet you're saying that somehow, and I don't know if it's not done legally how it's done, somehow you need to protect whatever bits of privacy exist at the family level or in those private relationships you were describing.
I think the law has traditionally recognized that it can't force certain relations to testify with a high degree of success without twisting their limbs.
Now, the law recognizes that in an implicit way?
Well, in very specific kinds of privileges, again, like the spousal privilege. You cannot force a husband to testify against a wife. Again, I think we're in a moment where a lot of that's under attack, and with it, many people feel the unit of the family, as somebody said, or perhaps the notion of privacy. But I also think that what's at stake in a larger sense for any witness is frequently a sense of balance between what is just or competing senses of justice. And again, I think that's why you see in certain nations refusing to extradite criminals to the United States, because we have the death penalty, as David Kuczynski said. You want to prosecute them. You want to have justice against them, but perhaps you don't want to see them killed. And that's particularly a dilemma, and a moral dilemma, for somebody who is related to the criminal in question.
I just wanted to make a point that or sort of respond to a point that the caller made regarding skepticism about what the FBI would do in Whitey's case. In other words, to prevent embarrassment about their cooperation, their protection of him in the past, that he might not make it back alive. I would point out that the gentleman who is most responsible, the FBI agent who was most mm-hmm. responsible for that corruption, is now in jail serving a 10-year sentence. His name is John Connolly. I would also point out that Connolly grew up with both the Bolger brothers.
Explain why this matters, though.
It matters because I think it matters in terms of both the fortunes, particularly Whitey's criminal fortunes, the fact that for a good 15 to 20 years they were protected. Whitey was declared to be John Connolly's informant. John Connolly was his handler. The disgrace heaped upon the FBI in this case really emanates from him and from a couple of other agents who were his predecessors. And that corruption tainted the Boston office and has tainted the Boston office. I think there is a great motivation right now for the FBI to redeem itself by trying to capture him. There's a lot of, and I'll be the first to admit, there's a lot of skepticism about how hard they are trying or whether, in fact, the U.S. Marshal should come in, step in and take over the search for him. But I think that when you talk about, you know, whatever perils Whitey may face with the FBI, those were perils that were really orchestrated in part by Whitey himself, because the relationship that he had with John Connolly allowed him to profit immensely and allowed him essentially to become the sole organized crime figure in Boston and the New England area for a good dozen years.
But all we're mm-hmm. still doing, though, is measuring the heinousness of the crime, not really measuring the obligation of the brother to say, okay.
Well, in that sense, too, the brother is somewhat involved, because the brother also knew John extremely well. The brother recommended John for both college and the FBI. In his trial, one of Whitey's compatriots actually said that when John came back, we had an FBI agent on our side because he owes my brother.
So, Patricia, in trying to strip away the fact that the man is a public official and that people see his name in the paper and his picture in the paper and have attitudes about him that may have nothing to do with his brother, I mean, that's a factor. The links that the FBI, that Peter's talking about, these are all factors, but do they alter the fundamentals here about what's a brother's obligation, what's a sibling's obligation.
No, and again, that's a difficult point that I was trying to make before. That again, his reputation as a public figure, the appearance, whatever that might be, we have to be very careful not to indict him for a crime that his brother, in fact, committed. And again, I confess that in this context, it's quite a messy determination to make. But that's separate from the question of whether it should, in general, be illegal for siblings. To refuse to testify on their behalf. And I think in that broader situation, you have to take into account the practicalities, the complications of the kinds of situations that family members find themselves in, particularly intimate family members, not all family members. And I think, again, the examples again, are difficult ones, but you frequently find, I think there was a case in Baltimore recently of a family that was firebombed, caught precisely in this tension between knowing who the drug dealers were, telling the police who the criminals were, but then being punished by the criminals because the police failed or were complicit with the drug dealers. At least those are some of the allegations. I think the same kind of complication attends the Whitey Bulger incident. Whitey Bulger, whose escape was apparently facilitated by this handler, as was described, and that's when by the handler revealing that he was about to be indicted, and he made his escape then. People close to the situation take that into account. It's a little bit like the very controversial arguments about jury nullification. Juries go in and they have their own sense of justice that takes into account all the messy, intimate, emotional, practical, the felt dangers of a community. And particularly, again, when you're forcing a very close family member to testify, the state finds itself in a quandary in terms of how to actually force that person to testify.
I want to go to Perkinstown, Wisconsin now. Anthony's on the line. Hi, Anthony.
Yeah, hello. I understand David Kaczynski's dilemma, but I got to go along with this Bulger brother. I met with the Unabomber people out in California, and, of course, at that time I wasn't aware that that there was such a person as a Unabomber. But these people that I met with, we broke bread together and had quite a discussion
Anthony, I'm not sure who you were meeting with, but I wonder if I can just get you to speak briefly about the Bulger case. You say you go along with Bulger. You're saying the brother should not have to speak against his brother?
The man hasn't had contact with his brother for 8 years.
Well, that's not entirely true.
Why should he be obligated to the U.S. government or the justice system?
That's not entirely true. He took a phone call from the brother while the brother was on the run. During that exchange, he advised the brother that it might not be in his best interest to come in. Now, also remember, William Bulger is a lawyer.
Oh. Well, that puts a little bit different light on it, doesn't it?
I would say so.
Yeah. If he's had,
but you're a lawyer brother of a brother, then you're not
as. And there was also discussion at the time when this conversation was revealed and when it came out as to what Billy said, there was discussion in the legal community as to the lawyer client situation and what most defense lawyers in that situation would recommend. Many of them canvassed here locally said that they would always, as a matter of course, recommend to their clients that they take their chances with the justice system.
Peter, I want to ask you though about the neighborhood again, because there is a pretty strong ethic from the Irish roots of South Boston that one doesn't rat on one's brother. That one doesn't mess one's family.
It's a real conundrum here because yes, while the idea of ratting period is frowned upon. You know, it has been established now that Whitey was a rat, that Whitey was an FBI informant.
So you can rat on a rat?
Well, it's an interesting thing. Many people in the community, a great many people in the community, still sort of go along with the idea that these are brothers and this is blood and he's not his brother's keeper. And regardless of the scope of the crimes, you shouldn't hang this around Billy's neck. On the other hand, there's a great deal of grumbling about the fact that Whitey broke a street code. He was a rat. He gave up some of his own people. And in the bar rooms and in the places where Whitey hung out and did business, this has been really hard to swallow.
So, Patricia, does neighborhood factor into this as well? Not just family, but neighborhood, community, all those elements that teach us what's right, what's morally wrong.
Yes, that's part of what makes it so messy. That's why it is the complicated ethical issue it is. Some people define community as their religious community. There was an article in the New York Times recently about a journalism student who reported a dishonest resume of the university president. And one of the questions came up was whether or not he should have told anybody outside the community, which was described as literally the community of Christ. Again, there are national boundaries as in the extradition context. Again, our law tends to recognize intimate emotional bonds.
Integrity
of the self is in the Fifth Amendment.
I just want to inject something about sort of street law. I mean, if we're talking about mm-hmm. different connotations of law, Whitey's problems right now in terms of what's happened to him were forced by actually two of his compatriots. One gentleman went to jail back in 1990. The story goes that he was told, "You stand up, you do the right thing, we'll take care of you." His wife had some problems, the house was taken away from him, and he decided that he was just holding the bag. One of the key witnesses who helped to convict John Conley was Whitey's surrogate son, so to speak, his first lieutenant. Again, left holding the bag. So that street law situation was not obeyed. That street code wasn't obeyed. That is why his own men turned on him.
Well, we're out of time, though. There's so much more that we could say about this. Peter, I want to thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Peter Gelsness is a columnist for the Boston Herald. Patricia Williams, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Patricia is a professor of law at Columbia University, writes the column Diary of a Mad Law Professor for The Nation. And we heard earlier in the program from David Kaczynski. He's the brother of the convicted Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski. And he's also executive director of New Yorkers Against the Death Penalty. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.